My name is Eddie Lindenstein, and you are listening to the Mind and Fitness Podcast for Wednesday, December the 11th. Let's start the show. Well, back again. I didn't even make a big deal, maybe I should have, about last week's episode number 100. There was no fanfare, there was no story behind it, and I'm sure in a future episode, maybe next week or the following week, I'll get into a little bit about how awesome I think that is. But before we kick off the show today, I wanted to make sure that I gave a shout out to the patrons of the show. So patreon.com/themindandfitnesspodcast. Patreon is a place for creators. So if you have a favorite podcast, favorite internet show, favorite YouTube show, whatever it may be, likely those people are spending the time and energy and money to keep and enter a component of entertainment for you on the air for free. And so it's basically some bucks in the tip jar. And there's about 15 of these patrons that are continuing to make monetary donations month after month. What's cool is that you go to the website, patreon.com/themindandfitnesspodcast. You say how much it is that you want to give, and then it's just recurring, so you don't even have to think about it, which is cool. So shout out to Jennifer, shout out to Eddie, shout out to Jenny, Sean, Christina, Holly, Ross, Caroline, Julie, Casey, Alyssa, Brian, Sarah, Adrian, Stan, Kristen, Sarah, Helen, Arnie, Barb, and Kim. So these are all people that support the show monetarily. And from the bottom of my heart, thank you so much for your support. It does certainly mean the world. So episode number 101. What I think is really cool and unique about this week's episode is that it contains a younger male, which I think is the first time that there's been a younger male that's come on here and told a really cool recovery story. So it's Chase Marsden, and you're going to hear the entire story. I came across him. I think I was searching for some kind of a particular success story involving somebody who was like a gym rat or a power lifter on YouTube. And somehow I came across Chase, him talking about it. So that's kind of what this whole story is about. And it's really interesting because he does have a medical background and he's in the Western medicine model today as a profession. So really cool to get his backstory. I'm actually going to jump right into it. There's not going to be a whole lot of fanfare here. This week is incredibly busy in my life. My wife is out of town on a girls' trip, and so it's just me and the two girls. And last week, the older daughter was sick all week. This week, the youngest daughter is sick the whole week. So it's been a wild few days in the Lindenstein house. But my commitment is to continue to bring these episodes to you. So again, every Wednesday since mid-May of 2018, this show has aired a brand new episode. It's pretty cool. And I just got a message from somebody this morning who says that they're on episode 10 and they wanted to know if carpal tunnel syndrome had ever been talked about on the podcast. And at this point in time, it's tough for me to remember 90 episodes back, but I'm sure that it has been talked about. So there's tons in the archives to find. There's pretty much going to be a recipe or something for every single person that you can imagine. So here's Chase. Hope you love his story. Send me a DM. Send me a message. Head over to Patreon. Leave an iTunes review. All that good stuff. I look forward to getting into the next couple of weeks of shows as well because it's the holidays. And so probably slowing down on the interviews and speeding up on maybe some of the more personal shows. I want to cover fear again. I feel like that's a big thing. And what I think is really cool about Chase here is that I feel like so much of the underscore and part of what Sarno talked about and what Schubiner talked about in the interview that we had together is having an indifference, getting over pain and convincing yourself that you're fine and how strong the body is. Like those are things that are paramount. And I think that those are things that are glossed over too quickly by people. And so Chase and I talk a lot about that element and really turning your back to this whole idea of pain and how stupid, just logically, the whole idea of pain and chronic pain being induced really by anything really is. And so that's a lot of what we talk about today. So thanks again for your support. Here's Chase and I. This is the Mind and Fitness Podcast. I am your host, Eddie Lindenstein, and I was mentioning this to him off air, but it is incredibly rare to have not only a younger person on the show, but a younger person that is a male on the show, which is, this will be kind of a nice change of pace. Chase Marsden from the Midwest is on the line. Chase, are you there?
I'm here.
So maybe a little bit of story time on how I found Chase. I was actually trying. So about a month ago, maybe a month and a half ago, I found you on Instagram and I messaged you and you were kind of like, how did you even find me on this? And I'm trying to remember back on exactly how it would have happened. But essentially, I was looking for something on YouTube about stories or anecdotes or somebody that speaks about TMS that is a guy. And then your video came up and I thought, oh, here's a younger guy. And I watched the whole thing, 21 or 22 minutes. And I was like, man, I wonder if I could find this guy because it's really kind of a perfect story for what it is that he wants to do with his life and what it was that happened. And then boom, we're in conversation together. So like me, you're an athlete. We do different sports. I'm in weightlifting. It looks like you're a little bit more in the, I mean, you lift weights, but it seems like you're doing a little bit more of MMA type stuff. Is that correct?
Well, I'm kind of an everything guy. I grew up lifting weights and I always loved martial arts and stuff. And so in college, like I really started taking martial arts, specifically Muay Thai, really seriously. But I'm pretty much a half and half baby power lifter and Muay Thai at the same time, which pretty much means diminished returns in both, but I can't seem to decide on one.
Well, it's okay to like multiple things. And, you know, how many of us are, I mean, even in like the sport of powerlifting, how many people are out there other than like Mark Bell making a real living out of, out of that kind of thing. I was just telling somebody this morning that I love Olympic style weightlifting, snatch and clean and jerk. It's been my thing for so long. And, but recently I've had kind of some unexpected numbers peak on PRs and like the squat and bench is getting a little better, but that I would love to have a 400, 450, 500 pound deadlift at some point. And
those powerlifting numbers, man.
Yeah. Well, like, you know, getting away from traditional snatch and clean and jerk and maybe spending like a year focusing on that. Then I think, oh, but I'll be mid 30s by the time I get done with that. But it'd be kind of cool to hit those goals. I mean, you know how that works. Yeah. You know that game. So what's interesting and where I want to actually start is, what is it that you're doing now? And then we're going to rewind a bit. So tell us about what you're doing with your life right now.
So right now I'm a nurse in the Midwest United States. I work on, it's a cardiac neuro step down unit. It's a very mixed unit. We get a lot of stuff, but I'm actually transitioning out of that now into something called care coordination, which is more about keeping people that were admitted to the hospital out of the hospital on the outpatient side once they leave, and chronically managing them, because that's become more tolerable for me due to the realities of the floor in nursing have just, that they take your toll on you. And I kind of had to get out of that for my own mental health, honestly.
How long have you been out of school and like actually practicing as a nurse?
I actually graduated in May, and the floor I was on that floor for 2 years as a student beforehand, and really just it's a floor where you get some really, so step down is, it's a classification between ICU and regular, what you would think of just a regular admitted patient, not in the ICU. So you get anything from someone who should probably be in the ICU to honestly just a totally normal patient that happens to be classed as step down. And then we get regular patients too. We get just regular cardiac, regular AFib. We get some stroke. We used to get a lot of strokes, but not quite so much anymore to take the burden off of us. But that's what you just see, is just the sickest of the sick patients. And just again and again and over again. And I was seeing that in school, and it was kind of eating at me, but in school, I didn't want to necessarily go to what we call it the floor. The floor is just what you would think of as a hospital nurse. So I didn't really want to go to a floor, but it's really, really hard as a brand new nurse to get anything but floor jobs, because you don't really have nursing street cred unless you've spent at least some time on the floor, preferably actually a few years, but you can get away with less depending on where you want to go into things. And so actually completely unrelated to all this, I'm a complete nutrition buff and complete just lifestyle fitness person. And so I want to go more on the long-term side of things, and just the floor, it was eating at me, because talking about the Western medicine way of doing things, we're just putting a patch on it. Like you see this person come in and they have multiple long-term chronic issues. They have multi-system failure and they're on, you know, 37 medications and they just had this one acute problem. We patch them up a little bit. We send them off. They may or may not go to their follow-up appointments. They may or may not actually take the medications in the way that we change them there. And really, they come right back, or they go to a different floor, or, you know, you see them a year later and they're in even worse condition. And it's, you just see this again and again, and you start to wonder, like, what am I really doing here?
It's like, interesting. It's interesting you bring that up. The statement about, you know, will they go to their follow-up appointments? Will they, you know, do the prescription basically the way to which we say? And I remember having I had a labrum repair about 3.5 years ago, labrum and rotator cuff repair. And I remember talking to the physical therapist who I was using post-op. And one thing that he said to me that struck me in the moment, and now I feel like I hear it all the time, is that he had said, gosh, you're so diligent in all your rehab, you know, twice a day, every day for months on end. And he had said that there's a lot of people that come through and they don't do anything. And I thought, like, they go through the challenges of having a major surgery and then they don't do anything afterwards.
Yep,
and he'd said it's more common than the approach that I would have taken, which is,
I would actually be surprised if over half did more than 10% of the prescribed rehab.
That is wild. That is wild. Because it's just, you know, like the whole reason that I did it was in large part to be able to get back to the sport that I love, right? So, but I guess maybe some, you know, people have injuries and surgeries and things like that, and they're not trying to necessarily get back to anything other than just being comfortable. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah. And especially the world of ortho itself. The world of ortho is a little divorced from a lot of other medicine in that, I mean, I have my issues with the phrase evidence-based medicine because it's not necessarily as evidence-based as we would like to claim it to be. But ortho especially exists in its own little world of kind of doing what they want and the surgeon. Because, I mean, really, if you're an inpatient hospitalist, like a pulmonologist or just a cardiologist, really anything else, you don't know enough ortho, and so you just consult ortho. And so ortho doesn't have a lot of oversight, and you'll see that if you actually look at the research, there's really not much to support a lot of what they do.
Yeah.
So they have, I mean, probably the best one to look at is meniscal tears that aren't bucket handle. Like, okay, you have a bucket handle tear. It's when it literally locks up. You can't move your leg. Like, okay, you need a surgery on that. Like, you physically can't move your leg because the meniscus is basically grabbing onto your joint. But ones that are just causing pain, you know, pain, quote, big old quotation marks. To get that surgery, they basically show it 2 years. There's no improvement in pain, but there is a nice gigantic increase in major tears in the knee, ACL, LCL, MCL, etc., because it completely removes your proprioception because your meniscus is a different size now, and you spent your whole life learning how long my leg is. You know, this is where things fit down, and you start putting it down at different angles because your leg is actually a different shape now. And so there's no improvement in pain, but you know, oh, you might completely tear your leg later. And yeah, there's so much of that in ortho. So, I mean, I have my own qualms with ortho as a field itself. But, yeah, it doesn't help people when they don't. That is the realities of the inpatient world. And I just kind of, I think why Western medicine has so much of an issue is, one, a lot of our approaches are debatable. But also the population we're working with is so divorced from what you would think of as normal people and what they will do and things along those lines that it gets really difficult. So to some extent, I understand why we are where we are.
Well, maybe this might be a good time to shift gears and go backwards. You know, the whole reason to which we're having this conversation, and you know, you went through your own bout of this stuff and ultimately came out the other side. So let's just spend a few minutes maybe talking about you started developing what were the symptoms, and you know, you were a nursing student while this stuff started and was going on. Is that correct?
Yes.
So you were learning about physiology and very much a Western medical approach, and then you started having these very real symptoms. What were the symptoms that you were having?
Oh, yeah. So, and probably learning about the physiology brought about that everyone, especially in med school, since they spend so much more time, like they med school hypochondriasis, where they start thinking that they have every condition that they're reading about. That definitely, to a lesser extent, affected me. But so I started doing Muay Thai on a serious level in my sophomore year at college, and I was always weightlifting, always doing things like that. And to be fair, I do think in high school, like I could never really figure out how to get lower body compound movements going. Like I could squat and stuff, but it was always with pain, and I could never figure out how to get like the neurokinesthetic feeling going correctly. So I never really did much lower body compound. And I do think my back's probably not the most efficient back of anyone. I mean, there are differing levels of athletes. Like I'm not going to be deadlifting like Kaylor Woolham ever, you know, probably, but that doesn't mean that my back isn't just fine. But I didn't know that at the time. So I start doing Muay Thai, and I'm trying to weightlift, and probably 4 or 5 months into it, I just started being more, not necessarily sore, but a lot of burning. I would describe it as burning in my lower back and especially hips. And I thought, man, you know, I'm kicking a lot more than I've ever kicked, and the Thai style kick is very much a whole body kind of joint kick. It's not like the karate idea of snapping out with your quad. So you're there's not a lot of impact on you. You're kind of, it's like you have a little ball peen hammer and you're striking right where you want to strike. But the Muay Thai kick is a lot more like a whip or a baseball bat. So you fling basically your whole hip structure at it. And I start having all these feelings. I start talking to a friend of mine who he's also in martial arts and is very, very knowledgeable personal trainer. And it was really the guy to talk to. And he's like, hey, you do not have any good core stability. You don't have like for instance, he was like, do just a body weight squat. He's like, wow, your mechanics are terrible. And my mechanics were terrible, to be fair. But it kind of reinforced this idea of, I'm slamming my joints into things and it's inflaming everything and I'm tearing stuff up, and basically thought I was kind of injuring myself, but I didn't really have an answer for that. So I just kept doing what I was doing. I didn't do any physical therapy. I didn't do anything at first, and just kind of kept going, and we'd take Tays off here and there to keep the inflammation down. But it just kept getting worse to the point where we had a lecture hall in nursing school that its chairs were like my nightmare. I would just sit there and I would literally be like constantly readjusting in my seat, always trying to rub out like muscles in my hip. I started becoming like obsessed with TFL issues. It's your tensor fascia latae.
Yep. Every powerlifter I've ever been friends with, it was obsessed with their TFL.
Yes, they're obsessed with TFL. Completely obsessed. And like, I got all into rolling out, you know, with a foam roller, which I don't hate the foam roller, but I definitely think people foam roll way too much. And it never really helped me much at all beyond like feeling better for 10 minutes after I did it. Great placebo effect. But so it just kept progressively getting worse and worse to the point where about a year after symptoms started, I started having issues really with just daily life. Like I couldn't really bend over and pick things up off the floor without some issue. And here I am still like kicking as hard as I can and sparring and going to the gym, lifting weights, and I can't pick stuff up off the ground without like hanging a leg out into the air. Yeah. So like my back didn't have any movement to it.
So that's interesting. When you're lifting the things and you're doing the physical activity, what's the pain? Because it sounds similar to, you know, when I was in the throes of mine, when I was still trying to push through and go to the gym was really when I felt good. And regular life was really what felt the most terrible. What is that similar to what you're describing, or is that something else?
It was definitely really similar. Like a lot of the time I could hit pads pretty well and I could spar pretty well unless I was having like a bad day, and then it would get in my head, or like really foreign positions. Like in Muay Thai, it's not exactly, you wouldn't call it wrestling. We call it the clinch. And the rule set is very different from, if you're not familiar with Muay Thai, you're going to be really confused with the clinch rule set. But anyway, there's positions where you can pretty much get your leg jerked up next to your head and they dump you on the floor. So if something like that happened, I'd be like, wow, that did not feel good on my back. But then I could get up, just kind of move around, shake it off, and go back to kicking and punching. And yeah, I could kick and punch. And the only time I would really feel it in Muay Thai would be if I'm doing more boxing style, like heavy body head movement, you know, so I'm swooping up and down and a lot, and I could still actually do that. I could just feel something there. But yeah, it was daily life where it's like I would wake up and be like, well, getting out of bed's gonna be, let's see how getting out of bed goes. And that was usually gonna be the judgment of how my day went. Some days it was like, I could barely feel anything. Other days it's like, this sucks. So I never really knew what my days were going to be like, and they had no correlation to anything. It was like you said, when you work out, you feel good, relatively good. I mean, I had some symptoms when I worked out, I won't lie, but it was not approximate to where I eventually started having issues walking on bad days when not in the gym.
Right.
And so, yeah, that made no sense to me. I was like, what am I supposed to do with that data? Like, I don't know what that data means. I can exercise, but I can't walk. I don't really know what that means. But anyway, it eventually got bad enough. I was like, okay, I'm going to go get some imagery. Because, like, I had looked up everything I could look up. I had my in medical profession hypochondriac self convincing myself I had an inflammatory disorder or an autoimmune disorder. Or I was like, maybe I just did something to my back. You know, at the time, I wasn't aware of what I'm aware of now. And so I go and get an MRI, and basically I had what they call, I still don't know that much about ortho. It's just not my area. But it was what the neurosurgeon told me. He's like, this is a large central herniation over to the left side, which is where most of my symptoms were. And he's like, there's no surgery that I would do on it, which I'm still grateful to that guy, because, well, I mean, he's definitely in the neurosurgery, orthosurgery world. Like, he's like, I'm never going to do this surgery on it. He's like, I can't do a laminectomy on this, which is a much more low key disc surgery where they kind of clip off.
What level was that? I'm curious in the back.
I'm sorry.
What level was that?
Oh, it was L5, S1.
Okay. Okay. So low. All right.
Sorry. Yeah. Kind of skipped right past that, didn't I? Yeah. Well, then that was the interesting thing too, is so it was L5, S1. So the leftward bulge onto the S1 nerve should cause, the words escape, sciatica. It should cause sciatica. I never had sciatica. Not a bit. Zero sciatica ever. And judged by my MRI imagery, that's almost the only thing I should have. So that's, you know, what do you do with that data? And I didn't know what to do with that data either. And that was actually something he commented on. He's like, you don't have sciatica. He's like, I'm not that concerned about that aspect of it. He's like, but the central herniation symptoms, his explanation was essentially it gets torn up in the middle, and that your body's attempt to repair that brings in blood vessels to feed the area, and those blood vessels aren't supposed to be in the middle of discs. That's what he told me. I don't know if that is actually a common phenomenon. I won't lie. But he's like, I'm never going to, he's like, the only surgery for that would be a spinal fusion. So he's floating, like, the only thing that's going to help you is a spinal fusion, which is a serious surgery. He's like, I'm not going to do that on you as a 20-year-old guy that right. is still able to go through life, which I appreciated that. And I wasn't going to get that surgery, even if he really wanted to do it either. But I at least appreciate his unwillingness to do a surgery that he doesn't think is totally needed at this point. You don't always see that. He's like, you'll probably find someone that would do it if you're wanting to do that. He's like, but I'm not going to. I'm like, okay. So I take that and now I walk away with that diagnosis in my head. And you can predict it. Things only got worse.
Mm-hmm.
So it did go to, I was having issues with daily life more and more. And I started taking whole months off of Muay Thai because it got to where I couldn't kick anymore. When that was what really started getting in my head was, you know, throughout all this, I could still kick. It was more just lifting and daily life that was bothering me. But now it's like if I would throw a kick, I immediately felt it. Like I immediately felt it just reverberate through my whole body and everything would start burning. I'm like, great. Now I can't kick either.
Do you think that some of the time when you were doing this, the kicking and getting certain, you know, certain feelings or certain sensations, and then the daily life stuff as it amps up? Because to me, it sounds like this doctor gives you this diagnosis. It's now you're visualizing this herniation pressing on these nerves and these vessels and all this kind of stuff and a potential fusion, even if you weren't going to get it. But that image is still in your head of all the hardware and all that kind of stuff. Do you think that there's a part of your brain that every time you're throwing a kick, this is what you're thinking about? This is what's going on?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay.
It did not help at all to hear that. It, yeah, it totally was like, okay, there is officially a problem with my back. It's not under recovery. It's not, you know, a small soft tissue injury that I'm not letting heal, because that was always on my mind too. I'm a chronic under recoverer. I've always had issues with like sleeping and stuff, so even at the best times I'm not that recovered. And at the time it's like I'm going through nursing school, which is generally difficult. It's not difficult in terms of you're not learning like hardcore engineering or physics, so the classwork is easy, but like the time put in is very large. And so I'm in a, you know, a stressful, large time consuming program, and I'm trying to work out 6 days a week minimum.
Right.
And so my time management was having to be very on point, and I was pretty much exhausted all the time. So I'm like, you know, maybe I just injured something minor and I'm just exhausted, so it won't heal and this has gotten worse. But no, then I go to him and get imagery, and it's like, you have an actual serious problem. I'm like, great. So I think it definitely accelerated my brain's perception of what was going on in my back.
Right.
And made it, yeah, a semi-permanent perception of what I could do with myself.
All right. So you've got these, you leave the doctor, you know what the case is. You're getting worse symptoms. You're taking, you know, a month at a time off from training. Did you seek out another doctor to say, hey, I have these images and what do you think's going on?
I did once, after, so I'll basically go through the culmination of all of it. So I kept going through school, and the summer before my senior year was when I ran into John Sarno's ideas. And it came because it just got so bad. Like, I would have, you know, ebbs and flows, like anything. And then it got to where for 3 days out of nowhere, I didn't do anything. It wasn't like an injury exacerbation. It just came to where my back, like, locked up. You could physically see this hump in my lumbar, and I couldn't stand up straight. I couldn't really walk. And it was at this time, a few of my old friends came to town, and I had this flare right as they came, and we still went out to the bars with me wearing a oh, what's it called? Those electronic stimulators.
The little E-stim thing. Or a TENS? Or
yes, a TENS. Okay. I put a TENS unit on my back. Like a hard, it was a very nice TENS unit.
And you
turned
the
way up.
You were the only 21-year-old in the bar with a TENS unit, I'm guessing.
Yeah, I had a TENS unit on my back in the bars for hours. And I just stuck it in my back pocket and tried to hide the wires. And they're just like, dude, that's probably not normal. I'm like, I know. But anyway, so this flare was just insane. And I pretty much gave up all my normal. I'm very much a hard science guy. And I hope we can get to some of this by before our conversation's over. But I'm very much a hard science guy. And I have some hard science issues with some people in the TMS community. But anyway, like moving on from that, I gave up all my, like, I'm not going to go to a research bank and I'm not going to try to look up studies. It's like, I'm just going to type in, I fixed my back pain on Google. It's like I was at my wit's end, but at the same time, I was like, I'm not going to let this win. Like, I'm 20 years old. At the time, I was 21. It's like, I'm 21. I should not be like this. It's like, there's pro athletes that have recovered from disc herniations, right? Okay, then maybe I can. I don't know. So I type in, I fixed my back pain. And somehow, by some giant stroke of luck, like the first three things I click on are these crazy, long, seemingly sane people on like having blog posts talking about the same guy. Like all three of them. They're all three talking about John Sarno and his book, which one was it? The Healing Back Pain.
Yep.
So I think that was his third one.
Third one.
I always get their order mixed up. They all mentioned that one. So I was like, okay. And it sounded like me. Like one guy, he described his back as having gone out when he tried to lift a refrigerator on his own. And like it got better, but then it just turned into this long 20-year span of issue. And I was like, well, that's pretty much me. Like I had some incidences in the beginning of my Muay Thai and when I tried to do some jiu-jitsu at first, but I just didn't have the time. And I also found out grappling with people 200 pounds heavier than you is not a good idea. And I had some moments where I was like, oh, like I got up from a throw or got up from trying to bridge a guy way heavier than you off of you. And I was like, that did not feel good on my back, but it kind of would go away. I was like, you know, that was like a little injury and it spiraled into this huge thing. I was like, well, that sounds like me. It's like, this sounds like my symptom presentation. And so I just immediately ordered this book. I'm like, why not? I'll order the book. I've kind of given up my, my hope for the traditional model, you know, cause I did go to PT after the neurosurgeon appointment and it was useless. It didn't do anything.
Yeah.
And so I got that book and I read like the first three chapters the night, like at night. And I was like, I don't know how to feel about this. And I woke up the next day and I stood up and I'm like, okay, I'm going to go do some Muay Thai. And I went and did Muay Thai. I was like, I'm going to kick this freaking pad. I slammed my leg into it. And I'm like, I didn't feel anything. I didn't feel anything at all. And pretty much from there, my mind was completely blown for at least a month. Yeah. At least a month, I was just like, I don't even know how to react to this because so much of it was, there's a phrase he uses in the book and I can't remember where he says it, but it's basically like, just do what you're going to do. And so instead of thinking about how I'm going to stand up from the floor, like I'm on the floor, how am I going to stand up to minimize the pain? Instead, it's just freaking stand up. Just get up from the floor. And I'd get up and be like, wait, that didn't hurt. I didn't have to like contort my back into some weird position. And this just kept going. I found it's like, there's really nothing that I can't do if I just do the thing instead of running through this pathway in my brain that I had created of how to avoid pain while doing this thing. And it just kept going, and it's kept going ever since then.
There was a guy. It reminds me of, there's a guy that I interviewed. I've had him on twice. Jim Prusak. He's the known as the pain PT. But he was trained by Serpa, and he practicing PT down in San Diego. But he stopped really doing the physical model entirely because all the data that he started to dig up and find and everything he was experiencing as a clinician in practice was not at all what it was that he was taught in PT school, right? So you've spent a ton of this money and time and invested all this into something that really doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And one of the quotes, and I'm paraphrasing what he said, but it was basically like, your body knows what to do if you get out of the way, which sounds like it's what you're describing.
Yeah. Like, I think the, you know, advanced PT has applications. I think it has applications, especially in like high level athletics. You know, if you're a low bar squat champion and you're trying to transition to high bar squat champion, that takes some breaking down of, you know, you have the muscle reservoir, you have the strength reservoir. What tweaks do we have to make to make you be able to apply 100% of your potential to this slightly different position? You know, that when you're getting into that nitty gritty, I think the physical model is a real thing. And then you do get into your own body anatomical differences. You know, you can kind of look at certain people and be like, that's a good deadlifter. You know, yeah, they're going to be a good deadlifter if they ever want to deadlift. Same with squatters. You know, you see those low set hips, you know, the thicker legs and the kind of smaller torso. It's like, you could squat, man. And so the physical model has its applications, but I think when you get to non-acute trauma injuries, it's just not the same. You see these things like frozen shoulder and, you know, chronic shoulder injuries, and they, you know, they say, oh, lift this, you know, 8-pound dumbbell 20 times a day and it's going to change things. It's like, yeah, there's no data to really support this.
Right.
Especially when something like frozen shoulder is kind of recognized as a neurological issue. And so I don't blame a lot of anyone that has experienced this, that was a PT, of becoming extremely disillusioned with what they're doing and how much they're really going to help people.
Right. So you read this book, you have this, one thing you said earlier, and it was subtle, but I feel like there's a bigger moment coming. You read the book and your mind was blown for a month. What happened at the end of a month? Is there anything, or was that just?
I mean, it was mostly a turn of phrase, but it does get back to what I did see another doctor, and I saw another doctor because so two times since I've read that book, were the only times I had another flare. Seems like a lot of people that I hear about, a lot of people on your podcast, a lot of people just peripherally I've read about and kind of how Sarno talked about, a lot of people still struggle with it a lot afterwards. You know, they still have bad days or bad weeks, bad months even. I've never really experienced that. And I think actually some of that is how I conceptualize it, which comes down to, I mean, I really hope we have time to get back to that. But I didn't have issues with it after a switch kind of flipped. But I did have two really bad flares just come out of nowhere. And one of them was actually the worst I've had. And like, I ended up like going into it was when I was still at school, and I went into my university clinic's doctor, and he had seen me pop in and out for like back flares before. And he's like, man, we've been fighting with this for a long time. And I was like crying this time because it was so bad. And it was like, I thought I had this whipped. Like, I thought I found this, it was my long-term girlfriend at the time when it like just went away. She described it as like the character in Doctor Strange that, doesn't like use the powers to like use magic. Instead, like, he chooses to fix his paralyzed back.
Yeah.
Just walks back into normal life. And that's all it really is.
Right.
She's like, I literally feel like it's like this. And it was like, that was how I felt about it too, but here it is again. So I'm like crying in his office, and he gives me some painkillers and a prescription. He's like, I know this really great physical functional medicine doctor. You should go see her. He's like, I feel like you need some advanced help. I'm like, and it kept going. So I actually went to her, and it was like the definition of scaremongering. It was terrible. Cause I had this book in my head, and I'd seen it work, and I'd seen it turn a huge issue into nothing. And the book had also talked about people still struggling sometimes. I'm like, okay, I think I just had, you know, some breakthrough pain. Like, that was where my mind was. And I go into her office, and she looks at my MRI images that I had and talks to me about things. And she's like, I think if you keep kicking, you're going to become paralyzed.
Jeez.
And I was like, I didn't believe a word she said. And but at the same time, I was just thinking, imagine if you didn't walk into that appointment as convinced as what I was. You know, I had a pretty strong mental model of how it worked at that point, and I was like, wow, like, imagine what that would do to someone's mind. And I walked out of that appointment, and within a couple days, the pain had gotten tolerable and eventually totally went away. And I've been kicking ever since, and I can tell you what, I don't think I'm paralyzed.
No. It sounds, the two biggest quote unquote experts that I went, and that's the thing is, like, I feel like I went to so many different specialists and so many different, you know, this is the best guy to go see, or this is the best woman to go see. And I feel like those people also had the worst case scenarios. There was one who's he's a kinesiologist chiropractor that's in Seattle. And I mean, he was just finding things that I wasn't even thinking about. Like, I would be like, dude, my traps in my mid back is what's killing me. And he would say, oh, well, did you notice the blood pooling in your hands? Did you notice that, that your deltoids are tense? Did you notice all this? And he said, you have brachial plexus compression, and everything you do with the force of your neck. And if you keep doing that, you're going to have this happen and this. And then a few months later, this is a month before I read Sarno's book, I drove 850 miles to Montana. I had my neck operated on and went home, felt worse. But one of the things that the guy told me that did it is he had said, you know, you got to stay away from the barbell and no more squats and things like that. He's like, if you put a barbell on your back where a squat's going to happen, you might just lose feeling all down your arms. And that could be a huge problem when you're squatting. And I had these images, and it sounds a yep. lot like what you're describing. And there does come a moment where, you know, I read Sarno's book, and the next day I got up and I went into my garage gym. I hadn't lifted in 6 months probably. And I just snatched 60 kilos and I was like, nothing happened.
That's awesome. You know,
that's when, and that's not to say like the problem was solved then. My story sounds a lot like what you're describing too, you know, some of the ebbs and flows. But ultimately, that first time where I hadn't lifted in 6 months, and then I can snatch 60 kilos, which was only, I mean, that was 65 or 70% of my lifetime best. But I was still like, you know, these people are telling me that if I lift, you know, a month ago lifting an empty barbell, I had lightning bolts shooting down my arms. And I'm like, but that doesn't make any sense. I mean, even all the imaging that I have that suggests all these problems, there was a doctor at UW, University of Washington. She's the head football physician. And I have to thank, I mean, I think my lucky stars that I met her, and then I got in on a cancellation because she said that, excuse my dog. She had said on I see your dog on Instagram all the time, so I know you know what this is about.
it's actually my roommate's girlfriend's dog.
Oh, okay.
That dog, man. Sorry.
No, it's okay. So anyway, she had said, I don't care what the imaging says, because it said, like, you know, carpal tunnel. It said thoracic outlet syndrome. It said that I had a nerve lesion in my back, a nerve lesion in my shoulder. And she said, I don't care what the tests say. She started talking about the psychological origins of pain and started talking about seeing a sports psychologist. And immediately I had just thought, that's really strange. And then she went on to tell me, you know, because at the time UW was, I mean, they had just played Alabama in the college football playoff the year before. And so she's coming off this very, very successful run with this team. And she had talked a lot about take a wide receiver, for instance, who's used to catching 10 passes for 150 yards and a couple of touchdowns, and then they come out and they have a game and they have four drops and one catch and, you know, 13 yards and no completions, maybe they fumble, things like that.
It completely wrecks them.
Yeah, that they may have some real physical issues, physiological symptoms that start manifesting and popping up. And she said that it might take five straight days with a sports psychologist to get them right, to get them for game time. And she said, that's what I think is going on. And she talked about the pressure that athletes put on themselves and the pressure that goes on in their lives. And I was just like, this is, like, I literally have like tears in my eyes telling you this, because it's such a, I mean, I talk to athletes all the time around the world that are like, I used to be able to do this, I used to be able to do that, and I can't. And you know what that's like.
Yeah. And you actually see that a lot in MMA, especially because you see the stats now, because it's become such a popular sport, especially on Reddit. Shout out to all the complete Reddit psychos who will do statistical analysis just for themselves. There was a guy that he basically compounded all of the UFC wins and victories and separated it by fighter, and basically showed that once a fighter started losing, they would keep losing.
Mm-hmm.
And if a fighter started winning, they would keep winning. And it shows like it's not a proven thing, but like the effect of the psychological train that you're riding. And it's like the Matthew principle. It's like those who have everything keep getting more, and those who have nothing, is just they keep losing everything. And that's so awesome that you had like a serious practitioner in the conventional system basically say that.
Yeah.
And that was what I really wanted to get to, is that I think the TMS community has an interesting, like, I feel like they have a hole that they don't talk about and how this should be modeled, because you see people talk about it in purely emotions, and I think there's value to that on a personal level of how to work through it on your own, but that if you want legitimacy as a field and you want anyone to ever consider it as a real thing that hasn't experienced it, because like I said, I am very much a hard science person, and it's hard enough for me right now to conceptually be like, yes, I believe this is real and I watched it happen. And so if you ever want to be taken seriously, that a better realized model needs to come into place. And when you have serious people talking about, you know, there's a psychological thing that happens that has physical effects. And I think what we're kind of at a point that could really be helpful with TMS is that we basically agree what we're talking about. And I think everyone has the same idea. It just hasn't been vocalized. And it's almost as if we're talking about, if we agree that how you see things affects things, like even a normal doctor would be like, yeah, stress can make your pain worse. Yeah, it makes your healing slower, things like that. But what the model TMS is essentially is that whatever consciousness is, which is a totally different argument, whatever consciousness is can be modulated to be powerful enough to affect your body like a drug would. For instance, you know, lots of drugs don't have direct effects. You know, antibiotics do. Antibiotics go in and kill the germs themselves. But lots of drugs like an SSRI binds to your brain in a way that it tells your brain to do other things. And what we're arguing about with TMS is that consciousness can modulate the brain to do things in the body like a drug would, and that it's that strong. And not only that, but it's honestly better than a lot of drugs could be. You know, opioids just block things, and maybe this is that. You have neural pathways in your brain, but that whatever consciousness is doing can physically change those pathways. And I think if we had this better scientific model that I think some practitioners like that, you said she was the one from UW.
Yep.
Yeah, like they get a conception of that probably through just the sheer number of people they see. And it's like, yes, sometimes this is a thing. But then you have the TMS community coming in, and they look like quacks. They really do. And you have some making some pretty wild wild gestures. Like, I mean, I don't know about the claims of curing cancer and things like that. To be honest, I've not done any research on that side to see if there is any legitimacy there, but it's like, that's a big claim. And to have a big claim, you need a really systems-based thing to back it up. You need something to prove of why this works. And the reliance on, you know, just reverting to talking about your emotional journey with it is awesome. And you need that on a personal level. But I think to get legitimacy within the medical community, there needs to be like a push toward, let's actually start talking about the physical side of this, of how this functions. And I think those people are the ones that you could reach to actually give it a little push.
Yeah, I agree. There's been the study itself has wrapped, and there's a documentary or a movie that's wrapping up about it. But when I interviewed Christy Weepy from the Pain Psychology Center back in, I don't know, this was probably May of last year, maybe June of last year. She and Alan Gordon and Dr. Howard Schubiner were going to Boulder, Colorado 2 or 3 times a week for this study that the University of Colorado at Boulder was doing. That was around taking a certain subset of patients that had chronic pain, you know, chronic or persistent symptoms, a variety of them. So we're saying, I think it was longer than 6 months was the marker, and where all other therapies had failed. So let's say chiropractic, physical therapy, anything that you can think of that was that, opioids, different things like that. And then what happens when we take a psychological approach to it and continuing to do fMRIs 1 to 2 times per week, what happens at the end of 6 or 8 weeks? And there's a trailer about this that's out now, and I think it's called Pain Brain or Brain Pain or something like that. But the nucleus of the movie is psychologists debating with medical doctors about this study and for the results to come out. And all that I've heard is that the results are very promising on that side, because they have, I mean, unfortunately, the world to which in medicine to take things seriously is and largely to me based on what are the images we can provide. Okay, so if the images that we can provide to get legitimacy are brain MRIs, then so be it, and that's the way it is. I guess my counter to that would be, I've got imaging that shows these persistent problems, and there's lots of people out there, yourself included, that have imaging that shows we have these disc herniations, we have disc degeneration. What does even that mean is another debate. But there's a lot of things out there that we can say make something legitimate or don't make it legitimate. But in terms of studies, I think that's the challenging part, is how can you study the brain? It's like CTE, as an example, unrelated, but CTE cannot be, like, we can't diagnose
yeah,
it,
in
a living brain. Like, we can't.
Yep.
So I guess, are there ways that maybe you've postulated or thought about, like, here's some things that doctors out there could do that are behind this thing that haven't been able to illustrate it well. Have you thought about that?
Yeah. Oh yeah. All the time. Because, you know, I'm, for instance, you know, I mentioned I'm obsessed with nutrition science, and the huge issue, even with studies, like, even if you have a legitimate study, and I actually hadn't heard of that study, I'll have to look it out. Maybe if, when it comes out, you should send me a link to it. But even with a legitimate, super powerful study, a lot of the time, no one cares. No one cares at all. It blows my mind. Like, there was a type 2 diabetes trial done in Indiana, and they just wrapped up their 2-year study, and they had these individuals were type 2 diabetics, and I believe there was a certain amount of time they'd had to have been a type 2 diabetic. So it wasn't super new diagnoses, you know, easier to fix, you know, when it's very new, there's not as much damage done. They had been diabetic for a while, and it was a large N study. There were several hundred participants, and they did a comparison between usual care, so just drugs, the same advice, and a soup, like, the only advice that they gave was a super low carb diet, and told them how to do a super low carb diet. And there was over a 50% reversal of type 2 diabetes. They essentially cured these people.
Mm-hmm.
The definitions they used, there was over 50% if you included metformin, which is like the first line diabetes drug. It just improves insulin sensitivity. But it's a very minor drug that actually lots of people that aren't diabetics take, such as Peter Attia, because they think it has lifespan enhancing effects, which I'm not sure how I feel about that. But this is a completely insane study. It's completely insane. It's basically saying, hey, everything we're doing about type 2 diabetes is wrong. This is a large trial. It was well done. And here we are. We fixed tons of people. So now, pretty reliably, we can fix tons of people. And absolutely no one in the medical community cared at all.
Right.
It got no press. It got nothing at all. And they took like all the labs on these people you could think of, basically disproved all of the low carb fear mongering. You know, their lipids improved. They didn't get worse. There was less DKA occurrences than in the usual care. So that one's not true either. You know, basically, you know, sealed the lid on what we should do for type 2 diabetes, and no one cares. And so you have this with TMS. It's like, even if you get a good study, how do we reach the traditional people? And I'm really thinking the best thing you could do is the practitioners to change somewhat how they talk about it. Because, I mean, I love all those guys because it's still such an insane thing to have happened in my life that I don't know what to do with half the time. And so it's like, hey, you guys actually believe this, and it's people I can talk to about it that don't think I'm crazy and don't think I'm ridiculous, and you've helped other people, and this is awesome. But there needs to be some serious study into the actual mechanisms, the actual pathways. And the best thing that I can see from that is a union of the model itself. Because, okay, if you have consciousness that can do this, if it can cause or remove pain, depending on how you're subjectively, you know, affecting it, you know, whatever I was doing was causing me pain, however I was using my thoughts, then I use my thoughts to remove that pain. There has to be other things you can do with it. And it kind of all clicked in for me that, yes, this is the same thing with two people that just made offhanded remarks. I was like, wait, what? And it was Tim Noakes was one of them. And he's actually famous in the low-carb community. But he, before he was like a famous low-carb doctor, was and still is like an ultra marathoner. And he wrote a couple books on running. And he basically fathered this idea called the central governor. And he was saying, you know, there's people who can run forever, right? There's David Goggins. He'll go and run 240 miles without stopping. And who else can do that? And that's actually bad for you. Like, there's a reason you get completely exhausted, because it's actually bad for your cardiac system to go under that sort of stress. So it's legitimately damaging you to do that. So how can some people remove the guardrails on the system and just keep going, and others can't? And his theory is like, it's the central governor. There's something in the autonomic nervous system which basically completely downregulates your ability to push past a certain point. And, you know, people fall along the distribution on that. Some get really tired quickly, whether their body really is or not. And other people can completely remove the guardrails consciously and go. He's like, this is my central governor theory. And then, on the other hand, Rhonda Patrick mentioned just offhand in a podcast she did that I looked up as much as she could when she was talking about. She's like, depression might have evolved out of sickness. Apparently this is an idea in like the evolutionary psychology community, where everything about depression mirrors sickness. Essentially, you know, you self-isolate because the tribe doesn't need to be around someone that's sick. It's going to infect people. So it's evolutionarily advantageous to isolate. You start moving less because you're trying to conserve energy, etc., etc. And so that basically, our autonomic nervous systems have evolved to where they're doing things. The central governor system has evolved where it's doing things that we can actually effect, but we don't really know how. And I think if that could all be pushed a little more forward and a little more unified to where people can take it a little more seriously, that it could actually gain traction. Because the biggest issue with TMS is that no one can take it seriously. Like you're saying, so you're saying my crippling back pain is all in my head and that I just need to stop hurting. And when the answer is, yeah, that's what I'm saying. That no one likes that answer. No one likes that answer at all. And I can't really blame them.
You know, as we record this, the holidays are coming up, and my I think I've decided that really the only purpose of the holidays is so family can get together and commiserate and talk about all of their health issues. And like that seems like that is all that it is, and I'm almost like dreading part of it. You know, I love my family, but that's going to be a large portion of it. And a lot of me, especially after having the experience over the last 4 years that I've had, it's like I don't even want to listen to it. Like, I'll go down to the kids' table and I'll read books with them because I don't want to hear all these adults talk about everything that hurts all the time. And my my oldest brother, who's not even that old, I mean, he and his wife have had chronic health issues forever. You know, a herniated disc, a car being rear-ended by another car 7 years ago is causing a shoulder problem still. And, you know, a partial quad tear from years and years ago is causing problems that a massage today will fix, you know, all this kind of stuff. And we just don't talk. He doesn't ask me about any of this stuff because the one time that he did, I remember I just said, like, look, here's what I know and here's the experience that I've had. And the response was, oh, so it's just some stress. Just, you know, it's just stress that does it. And I remember thinking, like, sort of, yeah. And you know, that's only going to be met. And a lot of the rhetoric that you're talking about, you know, essentially this thought of like, I'm just going to do it, and basically having the understanding that our bodies are not fragile, frail, and that they are strong as hell. Like, just go back and watch some of the old episodes of Jackass from the late 90s and the early 2000s, and just know that, like, Bam Margera and Steve-O and all these kind of guys are, like, leaping off of roofs and doing all this kind of stuff, and they're not walking around, you know, complaining about a shoulder issue. Now, they may have opioid addiction issues now, right? But that's, we're again talking about a brain issue. And so there was the most recent TMS book I read was by Dr. Mark Sofer, who's in New Hampshire. I don't know if you've ever heard of him, but I never hear him talked about. He was mentioned a lot in Steve Ozanich's book, but outside of that, I don't really hear anything. And I actually got an email back from him since we've been recording about doing an interview because he's a triathlon guy. He's a marathon guy. He's an Ironman guy. And his book largely is written for athletes, and he touches on everything from plantar fasciitis to herniated disc to all sorts of different things, rotator cuff tears, ankle sprains, all those kind of things. But his attitude and his approach to it, he was talking about one of his major relapses. You know, he's mid-workout and his back starts to flare up really, really bad, and he's literally telling himself over and over again, this is not a physical issue. This is not a physical issue. This is not a physical issue. Over and over and over again, and pain vanishes and never comes back. And, you know, he's not talking about the journaling ad nauseum for months and years and, you know, weeks on end and all this kind of stuff. He's not saying that that's not the solution, but it sounds like 99.9% of his solution is the belief that we're not fucking broken. And that sounds a lot like what your ideology is too.
Yeah. Oh, it absolutely is. Especially his mantra of mine became, when I stood up after the floor, off the floor after I read the first few chapters of the book, and like, it tried to hurt. And I was just like, nope. Yeah. And that's what I do anytime I feel something. I'm like, nope.
Yeah.
And you see that with, okay, we got rear-ended and my back's hurt ever since. I feel like it helps being into martial arts and combat sports. It's like, well, I just saw this guy get switch kicked with what looks like a baseball bat to the ribs. And these guys don't talk about chronic pain.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, some of them do at the end of their careers where, I mean, legitimately, you spend your life training as completely insanely as some of them do, never recovering, having hundreds of fights. You're going to be a little torn up, and I wouldn't be surprised at some issues. But they're not talking about, you know, in the midst of their careers, oh, I got hit four times harder than your car wreck hit you, and it's just never stopped hurting. They're like, no, I'm good. Let's fight again. Like, the the reaches that the body can be pushed to is so far beyond what our conception of what normal is now. Mm-hmm. That, yeah, I think there's so much fear around, oh, I have this injury, it's going to be there forever now. Because we're inundated with that. Of, you better not do that, you're going to have knee issue, or you better not do that, that's going to destroy your back. And it's just like, what do you mean? I mean, I understand, for instance, in nursing, you know, I'm legitimately a lot more physically capable than a lot of my coworkers. I mean, most of them are female. But as I transfer and, you know, pull up in bed 400-pound patients on my own sometimes when I have to, just... And it's, I mean, I use good body mechanics. I'm a lifter. I know how to, but that's more about being efficient more than about avoiding injury. Like, your body is not that capable of ripping itself apart. It can happen. I mean, people rip their ACLs apart and things like that, but it's so far past what we think is normal that, yeah, it's deep in our psyche now. And like you said, everyone is sitting around at the kitchen table being like, I have this injury, or I got bad knees, I got a bad shoulder. Yep. It's like, but do you, yep. or are you so physically deconditioned and you've been told you should hurt that it's just hurting?
Yeah. I mean, and part of me too, like I wish that I had some actual, I need to actually see if there's even data on this, but the idea of like social contagion and the power of suggestion, because part of me, I've been a big, pro wrestling nerd forever since I was a little kid, right? It's my, I love it. And, I know that the pretty much like the, so there's like Stone Cold Steve Austin, there's like John Cena, there's all these big stars over the years that whenever they have like a neck injury is like considered like the death sentence, right? They get some kind of a mm-hmm. neck injury, they break their neck, whatever. And I remember when I went to the surgeon who did my shoulder after I'd had, I don't know, probably four or five, maybe 6 months of really persistent back pain. And it literally reminded, there's a scene in, have you ever seen the movie Billy Madison with Adam Sandler?
Yeah.
So it's been a while. So there's the scene where the school nurse is evaluating all the kids for head lice, and they go, they sit down, she takes her little, you know, swab stick or whatever it is, and takes literally half a second like to look through their hair, and that's it. You're fine. And when I went in and saw my surgeon, he spent pretty much a second and a half looking at my back and then saying, oh, this is coming from your neck. You've got some kind of a neck, you know, neck. And then I start having so many numbness issues and tingling issues and reflection, you know, reflex issues and things like that. And I start thinking, I've got a busted neck. That's what all these wrestlers have. And that's what I've been thinking about for the last 15 years as an athlete is like, well, you know, the neck had to go. And now I start to see different CrossFitters that there was a big time CrossFitter, Brooke Entz, who had spinal fusion surgery in her neck. It might have even been just a disc replacement. It was something major that kept her out for like a couple years back. And then I started seeing this slew of just, you know, Joe Schmo CrossFitters that work at Amazon 9 to 5, and then they go in to do CrossFit, that suddenly have neck problems that are going and having all these neck surgeries. And like, if I told them, is it possible that because Brooke Entz, this other CrossFitter, had a neck surgery and it was very vogue and it was very talked about in this world, that now suddenly you have one? Like, is that impossible to believe? And I don't think it is. I feel like that's no coincidence, and that's, you know, that's a legitimate thing. And it's just, you know, the power of suggestion part is amazing. And now it's trickled down so much that Joe Schmoes that have these little minor things happen to them think that there's a forever injury. Meanwhile, I'm watching my daughters roll down the stairs and hit their heads and fall off of things. And, you know, essentially every time my youngest daughter steps off the front steps at our house, I just see ACL tear, ACL tear, ACL tear. Right. But like, kids they don't have that sort of conditioning yet. So it doesn't affect them. It doesn't impact. And I think some people chalk it up to like, oh, they're young and they're all flexible and they haven't had all these years of quote wear and tear, but also like they haven't heard people pound into their brain that they're going to be permanently injured all the time.
No, that's And I mean, I do think there's some extent to the, I mean, they are younger and things like that, but I don't believe in the wear and tear. And what I just think both sides almost go too far. Like the medical community just doesn't give any value to the mental side of things. But I do think what turns off the traditional community from viewing that as legitimate is that some people go really far on the other side. We're okay. So we've had pro wrestlers. I know, I can't think of his name. I mean, there have been pro wrestlers actually paralyzed legitimately from landing on their neck.
Yeah, definitely.
So, okay, that injury can happen. That's a real injury. It's not fake. And you could also say that exists on a spectrum, and someone could have injured themselves 98% of the way to paralysis. You know, they weren't paralyzed, but there was a real injury there. Mm-hmm. And so there's a spectrum of injury to where it's, okay, well, you can be 30% of the way there. There would be damage, etc. But what we don't have is a good definition of when you can have permanent problems from an injury when the injury isn't amputation or paralysis, etc. We don't have a definition of when that starts. You know, we say, okay, if it's all soft tissue damage, you know, some TMS people will be like, nerve damage is impossible and soft tissue damage always heals perfectly, etc. And maybe true, maybe not. We don't have a definition or even an understanding of what's real. Now, what I'd say with you is, yeah, you're a Joe Schmo CrossFitter. You didn't hurt yourself.
Yeah.
You're fine. Like, yo, your neck's aching and you were doing deadlifts last night. Did you fall to the ground screaming? No, you're probably fine.
Right.
You don't have some permanent complex injury. And if it ever stopped hurting at any point, that means it doesn't need to hurt forever. Like, oh, I had a good day yesterday, but today it hurts worse. Like, I don't know about that one, man. But yeah, it's the both communities just sprint past each other conceptually as fast as they can, and it gets really frustrating. It's like, I feel if we had better understandings of each other, that there could be a lot more progress on accepting one both sides. You know, I do think, you know, injuries are real. You can mess things up pretty well, but we don't know when permanent problems start.
And I think maybe the assumption is that permanent problems start a lot earlier than really they do.
No, absolutely. Yes. So much for, like, I would agree. You know, 90% probably of chronic pain, I would think, is honestly TMS. I mean, I speak that from my personal bias of having gone through it. Yeah, you know, it's pretty remarkable to go from how I describe, like, this long, dark hallway of constant misery. Because, I mean, it's so hard to enjoy your life when everything is pain.
Right.
You know, it doesn't matter what you're doing. Oh, you're sitting down at Thanksgiving. There's family members. It's so nice. Yeah, well, it hurts to sit.
Yeah.
Like, yep. It's pretty hard to enjoy anything. And so then when you see the pain go away, it's as close as a non-spiritual person can get to a spiritual experience.
I think I've used that exact quote before. I gave my mom two of Sarno's books for Mother's Day last year, 2018. And, I mean, she saw me at my worst, right? And then saw he's suddenly competing again. What happened? She'd said, you know, my pain is real, right? And that was it. Like, that was the only response. Well, okay, so we've been on the line for an hour and 10 minutes, which was longer than I promised. What sort of, like, closing remarks, if you have any, or closing comments, or maybe, like, you know, sum up your belief in a sentence or a couple of sentences? Because I get messages, I don't know, I might get two or three a day from people around the world. Sometimes they're in Taiwan, sometimes they're in Japan, sometimes they're in England, that will say, I'm struggling with this. I've been journaling for a month and nothing's changed, or I've been journaling for a year and nothing's changed, or I meditate, I do yoga, all these kind of different things. What to you is the missing link that they really need to hammer and drive home as somebody who's a younger male who had the same issues that I had and, you know, came out the other side of it? Because your approach is very in tune with particularly my more modern approach. What do you have to say? Where should people be spending their brain energy on getting rid of this stuff?
Man, good question. I would say, do not be afraid to approach your own way of doing it. You know, everyone has their idea of how you should deal with pain. Some people love journaling. Some people have never journaled in their life, including me. Do not be afraid to do what you think you should do. Be able to believe that it's real. And don't be afraid to live your life, because that's what I think one causes most relapses in people is the fear will creep in, and it will always creep in, and you're going to have a hard time with really everyone in your life that hasn't experienced this. My family and my friends are aware of this, and we just never talk about it. and it's hilarious. And you're probably not going to find that many people in your life that will understand it. But there are people out there who understand it, and it's happened. And find your own path, and don't be afraid of your own path.
Good words of wisdom. Well, Chase, thanks so much for your time. I DM'd you the Pain Brain trailer. I think it'd be really interesting once it does come out.
Awesome.
Because it'll reveal all those, the biggest study to chronic pain that's maybe ever been done, at least with something that's really quantifiable that people should be able to accept. And finally, that's when the results are going to actually be released, I think, is when the film gets released. So thanks so much for your time. I appreciate it.
No, thank you so much for having me on. I had a great time.